Case number 4 this morning is Jones against Briley.
May it please the court, Robert Will.
If you will wait till you're called. Mr. Will.
I'm walking in on behalf of the petitioner appellant, and I don't know exactly what status I have here. Originally, I was I'm a member of the trial bar of the Federal District Court here for the Northern District of Illinois, and I was appointed to represent this defendant in the civil rights matter that he had pending. And it didn't take me long to realize that that was not my calling, and I explained it to the judge, and I had been down to see the defendant on several occasions, and he wanted to make some money on the civil rights suit so he could afford an attorney to handle the habeas corpus and the rest of the state issues that were pending at that time. And I agreed with Magistrate Cohen that if I were to be relieved from the civil rights aspect, that I would handle the rest of his matters, including this one here, pro bono, and that was accepted, and that's how I got into this case. The defendant was tried in the Circuit Court of Cook County and was found guilty of armed robbery. The ex parte communications took place in that trial. Later on, that trial resulted in a mistrial with respect to the murder charge that was also lodged against him at that time, and he was later on tried for that and convicted and sentenced to a substantial term in the Illinois State Penitentiary. When I entered the case, there were certain post-conviction hearing petitions and things like that that were pending. Some had been found to be without merit. I gathered those together and tried to make what I could a sensible petition and to present it to the Illinois courts. I started with the Illinois Supreme Court. The Illinois Appellate Court had already ruled. The habeas petition was filed, and Judge Norgel denied that petition, and in doing so, he certified the appealability of the habeas, or the issues that are presented in this case, and that is the ex parte communication between the judge and the jurors. During the deliberations, the judge was absent, and he was at a charitable event, and he kept contact with his courtroom by telephone. Seven questions were asked by the jurors, relayed by the bailiff to the judge, and the judge gave his responses over the phone. The attorney for the defendant was not given an opportunity to give his input into those questions, and consequently the defendant was convicted. One of those questions was, what does reasonable doubt mean, or we need a definition of reasonable doubt. Can we have a dictionary so that we can look up what reasonable doubt means?
But the judge, the Supreme Court of Illinois has already said it's reversible error to try and define reasonable doubt.
Well, and I think it is.
Oh, okay.
And I think it is. I think that it is our position that that instruction should never have been given. Well, that as to what should have been done, well, certainly nothing would have been better than to give that instruction.
What was the instruction you object to?
Pardon?
What was the instruction you object to? What did it say?
The instruction said that reasonable doubt is what you think it is. It's what you say it is.
What it said, as near as I could tell, was reasonable doubt means just that, reasonable doubt.
Yes, and I think that should have been said, but it should never have been said. It is what you say it is.
That's not what the judge said.
He said what it means
what
to
it
you.
Means
or
to
what
you.
It means to you, I'm sorry.
That's just another form of words for I'm not going to define it for you. You have to define it for yourselves.
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that relegates one of the most important fundamentals of a jury trial in a criminal case to
the
mean
jury.
Whatever whims the jury decides to come up with.
Well, other than that, there would have to be a definition of reasonable doubt that he was given. He can't give that because the Supreme Court says he can't. So there you are. The fact that the jury passes on the subject, however, is not a shock to anybody. What specifically do you think went wrong? Now, listen, let's start with this. I think that the ex parte communication is ridiculous. And I don't know who the judge is or where he's been the last 40 years or so. But there has to be some element of something going wrong that prejudices the defendant. I don't know, other than the abstract idea that judges should bring in the attorneys and we should have a discussion and so on and so on, it went wrong here. What did he say? Other than that one thing you just described, what else did he say that was wrong?
Judge, the judges of the appellate court ruled also the way you're saying.
Right.
And here is what should have been done, to my way of thinking. The jury should never have been given an answer without the input of the defense attorney.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
And the defense attorney should have said no instruction. They have been instructed to continue your deliberations.
I agree, so.
But when you say, and I stand corrected, and I apologize certainly for it's what you what it means to you, I think that belittles a very, very important principle of law. And the analysis, I believe that in some situations, and Riley versus Deeds covered that sometimes an error is so egregious that it is structural and not susceptible to harmless error analysis. I believe that's the case here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Iskowich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Will, may it please the court. My name is David Iskowich with the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent in this cause. As a threshold matter, I'd first like to address the petitioner's assertion that this can be constituted as structural error rather than harmless error, trial error, which is amenable to harmless error review. The United States Supreme Court has set forth a very narrow category of errors which are termed structural, which defy any sort of harmless error review, which is not prejudicial to the defendant per se. Significantly, the Supreme Court has never held that an ex parte communication is per se a structural error requiring reversal and remand for new trial automatically.
You don't concede that these juries are ex parte, do you?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, do I concede that they're ex parte?
Yeah.
Yes, of course I do. We're stuck with the appellate court's opinion on this. This judge was out of the courtroom during deliberations attending a charritable function.
By ex parte.
Because here, Jones was shown the notes.
Normally,
ex parte is something that the other side knows nothing about.
That's true, Your Honor.
You know, it's a shocking kind of revelation.
The post-trial hearing on this was extensive and explored this in detail, and basically you had two conflicting accounts.
Yeah, but
defense counsel's assertion was that he was shown a response perhaps on one occasion, and that there were perhaps nine other occasions when he was not shown the notes in the first instance before it was communicated by telephone to the judge. And his other observation was that he was not able to give any sort of input after the response was fashioned by the judge.
So it's your view that these really were ex parte. Is that what you're saying?
Most likely, Your Honor. And again, the appellate court was uncomfortable with the course of events in this case.
Even though following the post-conviction hearing, the trial court determined that the sheriff had shown?
True, Your Honor. The appellate court, however, determined that this was not appropriate and did find it as ex parte.
There are a lot of things that are not appropriate.
But
are not ex parte contacts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The real problem in this case is that the defendant was not brought back into court, the jury was not instructed in the defendant's presence.
Correct.
The Supreme Court has said over and over that you're supposed to do these things with an exchange in court and in the defendant's presence. So there's plainly a violation here. There was error, but it's just that not all errors are a particular kind of error.
The appellate court cited the Childs case, which was a rather groundbreaking case in Illinois from 1994, and they did say what Your Honor just had mentioned, that the communications between a judge and the jury after the jury is retired to deliberate, except one held in open court and the defendant's presence, deprives the defendant of both fundamental rights in line with the Sixth Amendment. That was what the appellate court held. However, it did go on to hold that in light of the innocuous nature and rather mundane nature of the questions posed by the jury, the answers given by the trial judge, which were in total compliance with Illinois law, any error here was harmless. And on habeas review, the petitioner's burden, of course, is more stringent. He must show that the error complained of had a substantial or injurious effect on the jury's verdict. The petitioner made no such showing in state court, and in the court below, all he could complain about was the way
that... What should we think about the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Riley?
The Ninth Circuit opinion is completely inapplicable to this case, Your Honor. I think the Ninth Circuit defined both proceedings as a complete breakdown in the adversarial process where the judge's law clerk took it upon himself to read back certain parts of transcripts to the jury without the judge's knowledge or without the judge's presence in the courtroom. In this case, we have no factual scenario which is even similar or even touching upon what happened here. Riley is inapplicable. The petitioner also refers to the Delgado case, which factually...
I'm not really asking whether Riley is applicable. What should we think of the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Riley?
In Riley?
You know, I've just gone and reread Riley, and I am floored that it doesn't even mention the Supreme Court's opinion in Russian against Spain. The Ninth Circuit seems to have some difficulty with the concept of being an inferior court.
We share that sometimes, too, Justice.
Your Honor, do you want me to...
No, he was just commenting.
In any event, the answers provided by the trial judges, the court has suggested, were in line with state law. What it means to you is not a definition of reasonable doubt, but it's an instruction that the jury, in essence, should continue to deliberate, refer to its original instructions, and use its collective memory. One of the other notes involved a question regarding a request for transcripts. The trial judge said, use your collective memory to provide you with some transcripts at the expense of others would highlight certain parts of the case. You need to look at all the evidence in toto, use your collective memories, and arrive at a judgment. And as far as the jury's repeated questions regarding their inability to reach a verdict, the trial judge simply referred them to their instructions, told them to keep deliberating, and in fact, on one of the counts, they were unable to reach a verdict. And the attempt armed robbery, however, did come to fruition. All those comments by the jury were in line with Illinois law, provide no basis for relief in habeas corpus. And if there are no further questions from the court, the respondent requests this decision by the district court be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Iskowitz. Anything further, Mr. Willow?
I have nothing further unless Your Honors have questions.
It doesn't look like it. Well, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.